Coming up today at 1 on Hometown Heroes, forced from his home and the land his family had farmed his entire life, this Japanese-American chose to fight for the country that was holding his family prisoner.
This was our country. This is the only country that we knew, only country we're loyal to. All we thought about was doing what we needed to do for our own country.
Find out what he did and what that whole experience means to him now. That's today at 1 on News Talk 580 and FM 105.9, brought to you by Humana, proud to honor our Hometown Heroes.
This is Hometown Heroes. Honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the show where each time we take a trip back in time and listen to stories from our greatest generation. We want to preserve the stories of our World War II veterans so the rest of us don't forget the price that's been paid for our freedom. We want to honor them for their service and their sacrifice. And along the way, we sure learn a whole lot about what life was like way back then. We're in for quite a story today from 88-year-old Sherman Kishi of Livingston, California. And in fact, the spot where we're sitting right now isn't too far from where you were born, I guess. You could probably throw an almond hull from here to there, huh?
Just about you can throw it. It's right, very close. I lived there all my life except for those war years.
Although almond hulls don't fly very well. They're not very heavy.
No, but they're very valuable now.
Now, you grew up, like I said, on this property, and your family was farming what?
In the old days, you know, farming started in the community with grapes. So most of the farming in this area was grapes, but over the years it changed because the economy changed and certain commodities didn't do so well. So they had to change along with what happened economically.
Well, and the first thing that came to mind for me in Livingston is in northern Merced County. I think of the yams and the sweet potatoes that Livingston was famous for later. But back in the 30s and 40s, your family was growing grapes?
Yes, we didn't raise sweet potatoes in those days, but sweet potatoes did start very early, mostly started by the Portuguese people that came into the community, and they're the ones that really raised most of the sweet potatoes early on. We took over some sweet potatoes after we had taken out the grapes, and we had gone into some trees as well. But as an interim crop, a sweet potato was a very good crop because it was immediate. In 1 year, you had a crop that paid off, so that was used very much basically as an interim crop when we changed varieties or commodities, whatever you want to call it.
So as you grew up here in the 1930s in a Japanese-American family with a brother and three sisters, were there a lot of other Japanese-Americans around here when you went to school? What was the demographic breakdown like?
You know, this community was started by, I don't know whether you know the story, but it was started by a gentleman who came to the United States way back in the 1880s and established in San Francisco and had a newspaper for many years. And he also had other businesses. But I think that he used to see many of the single men that came to the United States to work, hoping to go back to Japan shortly. But they worked the fields, went up and down the valley, and my father was one of them. And I think he saw them spending their money in the wintertime in San Francisco, gambling and chasing women like young men do. And so he decided that he would start a community somewhere in California and make it available to those people that were the migrant workers. And so his name was Mr. Abiko, and he became very well known amongst the Japanese people. And he actually had a group of people that came together with him, and they looked for a place to purchase and decided on Livingston. And they bought 2,000 acres to begin with. And that became known as the Yamato Colony. And in the legal archives at the present time, it's still called the Yamato Colony. And shortly thereafter, he bought a couple of other pieces. One was the Cressy Colony and the Cortez Colony. And people then immigrated into these areas, and that's how we got started in Livingston.
That is quite a bit different than a lot of other Valley communities where Japanese Americans were during this time period, where they were a small minority. Sounds like, at least in this area, there was a pretty good majority of Japanese Americans.
Well, I don't say it was a majority by any means, but it was still quite a number. I remember the class of 1937, I think, was probably one of the biggest classes that came out of the Livingston High School, and I think they had something like 37 students in the class of probably 75 or 80 students total. So it was a big group, and since then it's, of course, come down, and now there's no one with a Japanese name within the school system at all.
Well, there is a Kishi Lane not too far from where we're sitting right now. Tell me what life was like for you as a boy and a teenager here. What kinds of things did you do?
You know, our social life was basically centered around our church. This has always had a church right here that became the center of the community affairs. And most of our social associations was amongst the Japanese people. We grew up with the kids in the school system, in the community, and so we had many Caucasian friends as well, but we hardly ever socialized with them. And that's just the way it was in those days. So that's how we started. But most of our activities were within. We had social events at the church. We also got together frequently and did a lot of swimming in the irrigation canals. In fact, all summer, most of us spent most of our time there. So it was a nice life that we had. It was easy, and I guess our folks made enough money to do well for us, so we did well.
I know it was a long time ago, but before everything changed, and it would change in a big way in December of 41, do you remember having specific dreams or ambitions that you wanted to do with your life?
Yeah, one of the things I wanted to do was not be a farmer. But then, you know, I came back from the service. I hadn't gone through college yet. I went into the service right after high school. So I went back to the University of California right after high school, after I got out of the service. And I took an aptitude test, and the darn thing showed that I was most fit to be a farmer. And I was sort of disappointed, but I did work. I got a degree in wildlife conservation. I worked for a short while with the fishing game, but the future looked so dull that I decided I would get out of there. And my brother was running the farm, and asked him if I can come back to the farm and help him. And I came back to the farm and been farming ever since.
Wow. And you're looking good for 88. I've got to tell you, it must be all that tennis and golf. You have any holes in one, by the way?
I have one. And I have a witness that became a judge, so that's on the eighth hole at the Atwater Golf Course.
How many years did you have to wait to get it? How long ago was that?
Let's see. I started golfing when I was 68, and I think I was about 78 when I first got that one and only hole in one that I've ever had in my life.
Well, maybe there's another one coming. Let's go back now. December 7th, 1941. Where were you? Do you remember how you found out about what happened on Oahu?
Yes, very clearly. You know, I was playing tennis in high school, and I was on the high school team, and so we practiced a lot of tennis. And this was early Sunday morning. There were four of us that went to play at the high school tennis courts to try to improve our game. And we were playing at the high school tennis courts, and as we were playing there, a car stopped by the side of the road. There were two or three men in the car, I don't remember, but they opened their windows and started to curse at us and call us all kinds of names, and it just really made us feel bad. And so, of course, we quit very shortly and went home and came home. And when we came home, we heard on the radio that Pearl Harbor had happened. And that was a change for all the United States and all the world, really, basically. But I think maybe a little bit more for some of us of Japanese ancestry in the United States.
You were born here. Did you have family in Japan that you were in contact with at all?
You know, of course, I was young yet. I was 16 years old when this happened. And my father and mother used to have contact with the family in Japan, but we had never, ever seen them, only heard of them occasionally. And I think my mother went to visit the family way back in 1934, but my father had never gone back to Japan, but he was still in communication with them. So, yes, most of our relatives were in Japan.
When you went to school the next day, what was that like, the day after Pearl Harbor?
You know, the day after Pearl Harbor is a difficult one to remember, but I don't think anything really basically happened at school. The kids were okay. They didn't bother us particularly. Later, as we continued in school, though, there were some incidents that became very onerous to us, and one of them was with one of the teachers that we had at the high school.
What happened?
Well, the family that lived where we live now, this place here, they moved out after 9066 when the Japanese people were still move out of state. And they were going to go live with a daughter that lived in Denver.
So for folks who don't know, Executive Order 9066 was President Roosevelt in February of 42 saying the Japanese people on the West Coast had to be evacuated and sent to different internment camps. So these folks here moved out.
Yes. Of course, the 9066 didn't say that. It actually gave the Western Defense Commander the right to do what he thought was right to protect the security of the West Coast. So after the family moved, they sent me a letter, asked for me to pick up their fishing gear because they were going to go fishing in Colorado. And so I came to the house or the garage where the fishing gear was, and I took it home and I sent it off to them. And the person that was running the ranch here for them was one of the teachers, and he just really got onto me at school and was not pleasant at all. And so that was one of the incidents that happened.
So you started to notice people's attitudes toward you and other Japanese Americans change a little bit?
I think it changed a little bit. We went on to school after 9066 until about May. And then in May of that year, 1942, the orders came out, and there were posters on the telephone poles and fence posts that told us that we had to go to an assembly center. At that stage, we quit school and got prepared to have to leave. So that's what happened during that period of time.
And you tell that very matter-of-factly, but I'm sure at the time that was quite a shock to you and had to be pretty emotional to be a 17-year-old kid and being told the place you've lived your whole life, you're not welcome anymore.
Yeah, it was very much so. It was particularly difficult, I think, for our parents. You have to remember that our parents were quite young yet. Many of the parents were in their 40s, late 40s, and in their 50s. And so they were in the prime of their life, and they had farmed here all their lives, and all of a sudden, everybody had to leave. So I know that once this had happened, they became so fearful of anything that was Japanese that I remember anything that we had in the house that looked a little bit Japanesey, as much as we could, we destroyed, buried, or burned. And that happened to all the families in the area. So that's the kind of thing that happened during that period of time. Yeah. And, you know, interestingly, they gave us this notice about 3 weeks before we had to go. The day that we went on was my 17th birthday. So I remember it very vividly. This was May the 13th of 1942. And that's the day we went into the Assembly Center in Merced.
Which is where the Merced County Fairgrounds are now?
Yes, it's where the fairground is now. We have put up a monument there in memory of that with all the names of the people that are on a wall. So that's where we got sent in. And I remember mostly being put onto buses at our church. And then we went on the bus to Merced. And we went to the, it used to be the armory there, right on 17th Street, and it's still there. And they took us there, and the first time we got there, we got out of the bus right in front, and there was a gentleman who was a dentist from San Francisco that spoke to us and told us that we had to behave and do what they asked us to do, and basically that's what we did and went into the Assembly Center, which was mostly prepared at that time.
How scared and unsettled were you? Because that seems like a pretty imposing and uncertain future you were facing.
You know, when you're young like that, you don't think of that as much. But I'm sure that the parents were very upset. For some of us who were at that age, were young teenagers yet, it was sort of fun because we never met so many Japanese people in our lives. And very shortly after going into the camp, we had some very well-educated people who had gone to college, unable to get jobs because jobs weren't available to people of Japanese descent. And so they were well-educated, and they immediately started things within the camp. And one of the things that started was baseball. And baseball became a very popular pastime in Merced Assembly Center as it was in the later relocation camps. So there were things like talent shows. I remember very vividly one talent show that we went to that had a young lady from Walnut Grove who had a beautiful contralto voice, and one of the most popular songs that was sung at the time was God Bless America. Can you imagine? Yeah, that's what happened during those days. Yeah.
And the irony Huh? God bless America when you're basically being held prisoner by America.
That's exactly right. Yeah. But we didn't think of it that way, I guess.
Have you seen the film American Pastime?
I'm not sure.
It's about baseball in the internment camps during World War II.
Yes, I have seen that. Yeah, there was a gentleman in Fresno who was a very strong advocate of baseball. He was a very good baseball player. He played against Babe Ruth and Lou Gehrig and some of those guys.
Kenichi Zenimura.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. I read his book. Uh-huh. and he became very dominant in baseball in Poston at one of the camps.
Yeah, it's really incredible the impact that Kenichi Zenimura had in America and overseas. That book, by the way, that Mr. Kishi mentioned is called Kenichi Zenimura, Japanese-American Baseball Pioneer. It's written by Bill Staples Jr. You can find it online. If you haven't seen that film, American Pastime, it is definitely worth your time. And speaking of films, this coming Monday night, October 7th, we're going to be screening the award-winning documentary Honor Flight, One Last Mission. What a powerful hour and a half that is. Huge thanks to the Clovis Veterans Memorial District. It'll be in their state-of-the-art theater auditorium in Old Town Clovis Monday night at 7, a $10 suggested donation. It all benefits Central Valley Honor Flight and the cause of getting our World War II veterans to their memorial in Washington, D.C. You may have noticed Honor Flight received a lot of unsolicited media coverage over the last week, thanks to that mystifying decision to barricade a memorial that was built with over $180 million of private donations. This belongs to our World War II veterans. Don't get me started. I'm not going to preach to the choir here, but I'd love to see a Monday night in Clovis. More information at cvhonorflight.org. We'll continue Sherman Kishi's story when Hometown Heroes continues after this. Our World War II veterans deserve a chance to see their memorial in Washington, D.C., and you can help send them there simply by renting a car. Between now and the end of October, visit any Enterprise Rent-A-Car location from Bakersfield in the south to Tulare, Visalia, Hanford, Selma, Fresno, Madera, Merced, all the way north to Sacramento. Tell them you heard this ad on Hometown Heroes, and Enterprise will donate 10% of your rental to Central Valley Honor Flight. Restrictions may apply. I'm sure you're familiar with Enterprise, but do you know why the largest car rental company in the U.S. is called Enterprise? The company's founder, Jack Taylor, was a decorated F-6F Hellcat pilot in World War II, flying off the deck of the Big E, the aircraft carrier USS Enterprise. Maybe I should get him on the show sometime and he can tell us how he earned the Distinguished Flying Cross. In the meantime, choose Enterprise for your next rental. Tell him you heard this advertisement on Hometown Heroes, and you'll be helping to send our World War II veterans on one more tour with honor.
On the front line of freedom, you're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes, visiting with 88-year-old Sherman Kishi of Livingston, California. As a teenager, he was one of more than 110,000 Japanese Americans uprooted from their West Coast homes and forced into relocation camps for what at the time was really indefinite incarceration. Where was the camp that your family was sent to?
All of this area was sent to Amachi, Colorado. Camp Amachi, it was called. It's right at Grenada, Colorado, which is in the southeastern corner of Colorado.
And what was life like there?
Like every other camp, it was in the most desolate place that they could find. Really, I think it was the most desolate place that they could find in Colorado. And they had trouble finding places for these camps. We know that it was cold in the winter. It was dusty because almost all the camps were made by dozing off the sagebrush wherever it may be. That was included Topaz, included Heart Mountain. All the camps were the same, and all the Arizona camps were all the same. One of the most violent and worst thing that we remember is the dust storms that we used to have, because they were so bad. But we all lived through that, eventually made the relocation camps a livable place. They planted trees and planted gardens, and things changed in those camps.
And how did it come about that you decided to go fight for the country that was holding your family hostage?
In 1942, after 9066, there was still a draft going on, of course, and they changed the status of all people of Japanese ancestry from a 1A status to a 4C status, which was an enemy alien status. So we were no longer eligible for the draft. So I, in 1942 and 43, I finished my high school, And during that period of time, they came in to recruit for the 442nd. And I was not 17 yet, so I couldn't get into the service at that stage. But just before I graduated, they also came in to recruit for MIS. And I studied a little bit of Japanese in the camp. I had a very, very smattering of Japanese in the community before the war, but very little. And so I studied a little bit in camp and learned a little bit of the alphabet, basically. And when they came in, they accepted me. I had talked to my father about this, and I told him that I wanted to go. And he said, this is your country. You go right ahead and do what you think is best. So my father approved my going as well.
And did your brother go in before or after you?
No, my brother is 4 years older than I am, but he had been going to University of California before the war. And my father became sick in 1941, and so he had to come back and help run the farm. And of course, the war happened, and so we all went to the camps. And as soon as he was able, he went to go back to college to try to finish his college. And he went back to Maryland, University of Maryland, and was enrolled there, and was going to school there. And the draft began in 1944. And I had volunteered into the service and got into the service in November of 1943. So I was in before he got in. He got drafted shortly after the draft began. So he came in 1944 into the service.
Yeah, once they took so many casualties overseas, they realized they could draft the people they had declared as enemy aliens after all, huh?
Well, I guess that's what happened. By then, the 100th Battalion came out of Fresno, had done a tremendous job in Italy, and they needed lots of replacements. When they came in to recruit for the 442, which the 100th became part of, there were many of them that joined at that time. Most of the people that joined when they first came in to recruit were volunteers, but later they were drafted and put into the service, and most of them went into the 442.
And that 442nd Regimental Combat Team, of course, is legendary for its courage, its bravery, the amount of decorations per capita blows everything else away in World War II. And you mentioned you were too young to join the 442 when they came through. Had you been old enough, do you think you would have?
I probably would have, yes, because I had many friends that did. So, yeah, I probably would have joined if I was old enough.
You had many friends that joined. How many of those friends came home?
In our small community, we lost three in Italy and France. And so that's a pretty good percentage of young men that we lost in Europe with the 442.
Have you ever thought about that? That had you been able to join the 442nd and went over there, whether or not you would have survived?
Oh, yeah. I've thought about that many times. But I had a brother-in-law married to my youngest sister. That's before he's married. He was in the service and was sent over there. But he survived through all the battles, and he was a company runner. And a company runner's job was the communication between the front lines and the company. So he was in a very dangerous position, but he survived without a scratch through all that. And so you never know, when that happens, it just happens. So you can't tell what's going to happen.
No, you can't. And of course, you didn't serve in the 442nd, but I imagine you still take some pride in what those people who were facing similar circumstances as you were did accomplish. When you hear someone talk about today that phrase, go for broke, does it mean something to you? And if so, what?
That phrase means a lot. That means you do everything that you possibly can to do whatever you're doing. The young men that were my friends who were in MIS, there were a number of them killed as well in the Pacific. And they did a tremendous job over there. I had a good friend that ended up in Burma as part of the Mero Marauders. And he went through that campaign, and he survived through it. There was a lot of things that happened in the Pacific as well as in the 442 in Europe.
Well, and I want to hear about what you did. And some folks might not know what MIS stands for. That's Military Intelligence Service?
That's correct. Yeah, Military Intelligence Service is what we were in. You know, when I got out of school, I had to go to basic training after that, after I learned my Japanese. And so by the time I was eligible to go overseas, it was starting to get a little late in the war. And I was ready in 1945, finally, after basic training and after my training. I went through a 9-month program of learning Japanese.
Was that hard for you?
Oh, was that ever hard? Can you imagine getting up at 6 o'clock in the morning and getting ready for reveille and all that, and then going to class at 8 o'clock, staying in class until 4 o'clock, and then having your military things after that. And then we went back to classes at 7 o'clock at night, and we stayed there until at least 9. Wow. And so we had all that time to learn the Japanese language, and it was not easy, and we didn't have enough time. So we used to put flashlights under the blanket. We used to go to the latrine where there's light, and we used to study so we could learn enough to get by. Yeah, it was the toughest schooling that I ever went through.
I know you lived it, and it's easy to maybe in retrospect not read too much into it. But I think a lot of people that didn't go through what you went through think, where do you find the motivation to put in that kind of effort, again, for a government, for a country that is holding your family prisoners, you know, that you've had to move away from the land that you've had your entire life, and here they are in this internment camp? How did you get past that mentally and emotionally, and how would you describe the mindset you did have?
You know, I didn't think about that very much, frankly. This was our country. This is the only country that we knew, and this is the only country we're loyal to. All we thought about was doing what we needed to do for our own country. We knew that Japan, our folks came from Japan, but that really didn't cut any ice with us because we never knew any of those people over there. And so they became our enemies, basically.
And that attitude you described, did you feel like that was pretty common among the other men that you were training with?
Yes, I think so. I think so. Although you have to realize that when we went to the MIS, there were many young men who were called Kibes. And Kibe means a young person of the ancestry who were sent back as citizens from the United States to Japan to be educated. And so there were many of those people that were in MIS. And some of them had some completely different feelings about it. There were some of the Kibes who were very hopeful that Japan would win. But basically, they were very loyal to the United States. And most of the translating and interpreting that was done in the Pacific was basically done by the Kibes. The Niseis were not very strong in Japanese, and so they did most of the English writing that had to be done on the reports and things. And so you have to give a lot of credit to those young men who learned the language in Japan and came back and fought for the United States.
So after 9 months of that schooling, staying up with your flashlight to study Japanese, what happened next?
One of the interesting things about that period is that they had some classes for the Caucasian people to learn Japanese. They had a class at the University of Denver. They also had a class at University of Michigan. And this was to learn Japanese to become translated interpreters. And they went to the university, learned the language for 2 years. When they got done, they came out with bars on their shoulders. They became lieutenants. When we came out of our school, after 9 months, and some of them were in 6 months class, if we were lucky, we came out with 2 stripes on our arm as corporals. So things were a little different.
Yeah.
That's sort of interesting that such a thing as that happened. After that happened, we waited for a while, and in July of 1945, I got onto a ship out of San Francisco, and I remember the Golden Gate Bridge going away, wove our way back and forth across the Pacific. It took us a whole month to get to the Philippines. I was, along with many other the young men, were put into what they call ATIS, which is Allied Translating and Interpreting Section. This is of MIS. There's a racetrack right out of Manila, and that's where we were stationed. And we did some translating and things while we were there. I was there for about a month, and of course the war ended in August. By the middle of August, it was all done. Japan had surrendered. And so shortly thereafter, they sent us into Japan as part of the occupation forces. And we were in Japan in September of 1945 as part of the occupation force. And one of the things that I remember about that so vividly is when we got into Yokohama and embarked there, they still had a few trains running. And so they put us on a train to go into Tokyo. And we were sent into the finance building in Tokyo, the federal finance building there, as a billet. And all the way from Yokohama to Tokyo, which is about 20 miles, it was nothing but black. The incendiary bomb that the United States had dropped was so effective that that whole 20-mile section was completely devastated. And I remember that very clearly.
How hard was that to see, just as a human being, to realize the impact of that bombing? What was that like for you as a young man to look out the window of that train and see that?
Yeah, it was total devastation it was. But you know what I thought about? I was in the Philippines, and the Philippines had been bombed as well, of course, you know. And so the city of Manila, we went in there when we had some time off, and there was nothing done to improve any of the devastation there. There was stuff scattered on the sidewalks and into the streets and all that, and it was still a mess. When we went to Japan, in spite of the fact that everything was black, there were people with wheelbarrows cleaning up any debris that was there. So I thought, oh my goodness, what a difference in the attitude of people. And I always wondered why, but I think what happened was that's the difference of people's energy within a subtropical or tropical area versus a area where the climate is so much nicer. And I really think that's what makes those people do what they did in Japan.
Having just come back from a football game in Hawaii last week, I guess I can back that up, because things do tend to go a little more slowly in those tropical locales. You mentioned the war coming to an end. Do you remember where you were and how you heard that Japan had surrendered and what that meant to you at the time?
We were in the camp in Manila at the racetrack. And when we heard that the surrender had happened, we were very gleeful, of course, that that had happened. We knew that there would be no more war. And so we were, I don't exactly remember the celebration that we had. That was fine, but even in spite of that, you know, there was still fighting going on in the Philippines, and there were occasional bodies that came floating down the river that was right next to the camp there. So we didn't think that much of the change that was going to happen, but it did change tremendously very shortly.
Being there in Japan as part of the occupation forces, I imagine at some point you interacted with the Japanese people. What was that like? I'm sure there are a couple things that stand out about those interactions.
People were fearful that the Japanese people were going to resist them considerably. Those of us who were translators and interpreters who were in MIS, we spoke the language, and we just looked just like the people that were there. And so they accepted us very quickly, and we became very friendly with people very quickly, and we visited different families there and actually had a good time while we're there, really, in spite of the fact that we were the conquerors. So we just sort of somewhat felt like we came home, I guess. I remember before I came home, I took a furlough, took 10 days off, and I went to visit my relatives who had never seen before and never been near. And they were in the city of Wakayama, which is quite a ways from Tokyo. It's about a four-hour trip on the train. The one feeling that I had when I got there to my father's family home and with the people that I knew nothing about was that I felt like I went home. It was an amazing feeling that such a thing happened, but it did. I really did feel like I went home.
So they must have treated you pretty well, and I guess without the war, maybe that never would have happened?
Probably not, but I remember how things were so bad in Tokyo. People had no food. I remember young girls with rucksacks that used to go out to the country with all their whatever belongings they had that they could trade, took them out to the country and traded for sweet potatoes and brought them back so the family could eat. Our families in Wakayama were no better off. They were very poor. I remember filling my duffel bag as full as I could with everything that I could, and I took it with me when I went down there and distributed it to these people. 30 years later, when we went to visit, they were kids at the time. They still talked about it. It's amazing.
Wow. That is really something. What a unique perspective you have on all of this. And we're going to get more of that perspective from Sherman Kishi. If you want to see how youthful this 88-year-old golf and tennis player remains, well, I know you hear it in his voice too, but you can find photos on Facebook. Just type in Hometown Heroes Radio. Back with the rest of Mr. Kishi's story right after this. They say a picture is worth a thousand words, but when it comes to making my mouth water, I don't need a thousand words, just two of them. Mongolian beef. Okay, two more. Ming's Restaurant. And I guess if you want to know where to find it, I should give you two more. Las Banas. That's where I grew up. And I'm guessing Las Banas is somewhere you pass through every now and then. And if you drop in for the Mongolian beef, you might start calling it what I have for years. My favorite place to eat.
period. He may not look old enough for this to be true, but the owner, Paul Cito, has been working his magic in the kitchen there for 45 years now. It's all delicious. If you're a garlic fan, try the Baja shrimp and thank me later. But the Mongolian beef is absolutely unmatched. The flavor, incredible. The texture, tremendous. I can't do it justice with words. You just got to go taste it. One word of caution, do not go on Monday because Ming's is closed on Mondays. So pick another day, tell them I sent you, and let me know if your taste buds enjoy it as much as mine do. That's Ming's Restaurant, 435 West Pacheco Boulevard in lovely Las Banas, California.
If you are a World War II veteran and you have not been to the World War II Memorial in Washington, D.C., Honor Flight wants to take you there, free of charge. The sooner you submit an application, the sooner Honor Flight can get you to your memorial. In Kern County or the Central Coast, call Lily Marsh at 661-544-VETS. That's 661-544-VETS. Or go to honorflightkerncounty.org. For Fresno, Madera, Merced, Mariposa, Kings, or Tulare counties, check out CV Honor Flight, CV as in Central Valley, CVHonorFlight.org, or call Al Perry at 559-970-9853. That's 559-970-9853. Maybe you're the son or daughter of a veteran and you'd like to go along as a guardian. There are applications for that too, and there are other ways you can help. Donations to Honor Flight are tax deductible. We all owe our freedom and liberty to the men and women who put their lives on the line for it. Let's all come together now behind Honor Flight and give our veterans one more tour with honor.
This is Hometown Heroes. Honoring everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes. Our guest today, Sherman Kishi of Livingston, California. He served in the MIS, Military Intelligence Service, in World War II, one of over 19,000 Nisei veterans who put their lives on the line for a country that was holding their families behind barbed wire and internment camps. Those Nisei veterans were honored in 2011 with the Congressional Gold Medal, and Mr. Kishi was there in Washington, D.C. for all of that. But let's go back to the end of World War II.
What was it like to come back home after all of that? All the training, everything you saw in the Philippines and in Japan, and then to come back to the States. What do you remember about that?
Well, you know, I had a girlfriend, the girl that's sitting in this house with me. And so I was anxious to get home. And so I was ready to come home, and I knew I wanted to go back to college. With the government's help under the GI Bill, I went through UC Berkeley and finished school there. So that was a prime thing in my mind at that time.
Well, you mentioned your girlfriend. She's now your wife of 67 years. So tell me the story. How did you guys meet?
We were just talking about that the other day. There was a World's Fair in 1939 in San Francisco. I don't know whether you remember such a thing, but it was on what they call Treasure Island, and my brother was going around with my wife's sister at the time. And so we drove up there and went to the World's Fair, and that's how I got to know June.
Mm-hmm. So it was a car ride to the World's Fair in 1939 where you met, and then you go off to war. Did you guys keep in touch? Did she send letters to you while you were in the military?
All the time, yes. Yes, we were in touch all the time that I was in the service, yeah.
And I've heard lots of different versions of this from different veterans. Did you make any promises before you went overseas? Did you go ahead and ask her to wait for you and marry you when you got back, or did you just leave that one alone?
I don't remember asking her. I better not say this. I mean, be careful what I say. But we just took it for granted that we're going to get married. So when I came back, as soon as I came back, we got married. I came back in March of 1946, end of March. And we got married in September, and went right to the University of California after that, together with her. And she helped me through college. She worked, and I went to school.
A lot of people don't even realize how much of a challenge it was for a lot of Japanese-American families to get their land back, if that was even an option. In your case, here you are on the property where you were born. How did that work out? How was it that your family came to recover this land after the war was over?
My family was not part of the cooperatives. So we asked our high school ag teacher, who we knew was a very nice gentleman, to run our farm for us. And his name was Eldon Callister. He ran our farm for us during that period of time. And the person that was what we call the chicken doctor, because we had chickens across the street there, egg-laying chickens. And he took over our house and continued that business there. And I think they all did quite well farming for us during that period of time, because they left some money in the bank for us when we came back. So we had some very fortunate friends to have. And I didn't realize that Eldon Callister was a Latter-day Saint at the time, but he was. And he was a very honest man and did a great job for us. So we were very fortunate.
And I guess at that time, maybe you didn't realize how fortunate you were. But in the years since, as you've met other Japanese-American veterans, has it struck you that, your situation and how that worked out for you was a lot better than a lot of Japanese-American families experienced?
There's no question about that. Most of the people that lived in the cities lost their businesses, lost everything that they had, and they didn't have too much to begin with. So when they came back, they had to start all over again, and it was very difficult for them. I have a friend who had a father that was put into the camps along with us. He couldn't find a job. He just really became mentally distraught as a result of that. And this happened to many people, I think, during that period of time. It was a tough time for people to come back to California after the war. It was very difficult.
Do you remember any special moments that you had with your family after you were back, when your whole family was together again after everything that you'd gone through?
Yes, we had many good gatherings of the family, including my wife's family. My wife's sister was married to one of the Kodas, who were rice farmers in Dos Palos, and they used to come to Livingston to join our gatherings that we had. Anytime we had a birthday party or something like that, the whole family got together. So there were many gatherings that we got together at and had wonderful times together.
I know another wonderful time for you was getting to go to Washington, D.C. You've been on an honor flight through Northern California Honor Flight, but you also got to go back when the Congressional Gold Medal was given to all Nisei veterans of World War II. The Medal of Honor winner himself, Senator Inouye, was there with you guys. What was that whole experience like for you, and what did you take away from it?
You know, I think that was one of the most wonderful experiences that I ever had, that the United States would do such a thing for those of us who were incarcerated in these camps during the wartime years, and yet, in spite of that, having a Congressional Gold Medal given to those of us who were part of the military at that period of time. It was a wonderful time. You know, there were a lot of veterans that were there. There were two of them that actually died while they're there because they were getting so old, and there were many in wheelchairs. And in spite of that, they took us, and we had sirens that took us on buses down to the World War II Memorial, and we had a great time there. It was a wonderful period of time for us. Yeah. Mm-hmm. It was great.
And I imagine when you were up at night studying Japanese, or were you were on a boat to the Philippines or taking that train to a devastated Japan, you never thought that you'd be in Congress getting a gold medal with all these other Japanese American veterans.
Had no inkling of such a thing. It was a wonderful occasion that just happened to happen for us, and it was great that it did. We appreciate it very much.
Did it make you proud, would you say, to go through that, to receive that with your fellow veterans?
Made me very proud to be a part of the United States. And one of the nicest thing about it is in the United States that they would do something like this for us through congressional action, which is something that I don't think any other country would ever do.
When you think back on it, is there something that that you're most proud of or most thankful for with the unique experience that you've been able to have?
You know, when I went to college, I was a wildlife conservation major. And what I'm in now in farming is not near what that would entail, one would think. But it's amazing that what I learned in college became also applicable to my agricultural work. That it was amazing to me when I finished college that I was able to use all that. So So that was sort of interesting that that happened during this period of time. And we were having a lot of difficulties, too, at the first, you know, when we first started. But we were very fortunate. We bought land when land was still cheap before the big prices came in. So we did very well on what we were able to do. But my brother and I did this together.
When you think about your children and your grandchildren, now you have a great-grandchild. What do you hope that they understand about what Japanese Americans went through in America during World War II, what you and your family went through? What do you hope they know years and years from now?
Well, that's a pretty tough question. I think that the thing that they will probably learn is that this country, which is unique in the world, I think, is able to do things to right what was done that was wrong at the particular time. And this country did do that for us. They righted the wrong when they had the redress action back in 1988. There was a lot of activity that went into that. It took 10 years before this happened. There were many congressional hearings and things that went on. But at that time, they gave an apology to us for letting that happen. And, of course, they gave us some redress as well. They gave us each $20,000 as a result of the relocation that they did. And one of the things that I prize the most is the apology that came from President Bush, because he was the president at the time that they sent the letters out. So I hope that the children will look at that and realize what a great country we have.
Well, I want to thank you for serving our country, and thank you for telling us your story in a really impressive fashion. I guess the other thing I have to ask you, if you've been married for 67 years, you must be doing something right. So for the rest of us who aspire to longevity like that in our marriages, what advice or secrets would you share with us?
Mostly to like each other. We've had very few arguments. We've gotten on very well together. I think mostly it's you just have to learn to like each other a lot. Mm-hmm. Yes.
Anything else?
That's basically the only advice I can give you. Thank you for interviewing me. I hope that people find it interesting.
Well, there's no doubt in my mind they will. I guess the one more thing I should ask you, right next to where we're sitting, you have a replica of the statue that is at the Merced County Fairgrounds, the site of the Assembly Center where your family was taken, when that big statue was put in there at the fairgrounds. So here in your home county, your home area, there was something to recognize what your family and so many others went through. Well, what would you say that meant to you when that took place?
You know, you have to realize that I was highly involved in it. This was basically done by the Japanese American Citizens League. When we first got word of it was when Dennis Cardoza was a congressman. He called and said that there's some money available. So would we put up some kind of a memorial to memorialize the fact that the Merced Assembly Center was there at the fairgrounds. And so we thought, and he also said there would be some money coming to us as a result of that. And so we thought, well, maybe we could put up something, and we thought very hard about it. We have an architect in Turlock that was part of our group. His name is Ernie Yoshino. Mm-hmm. And he was the one that suggested that maybe we put up a monument like this. And so we contacted the people in Berkeley who had a foundry. There was a sculptor there who was ahead of it. And so he agreed to do this for us. And we went up there a number of times to see that everything is the way we want it. We took all the suitcases up, and he used those to be bronzed. And so we went through the whole process. And we appealed to our people, and we appealed to them for funds to do this. We thought it would cost about $50,000 to do the total. We ended up appealing to the people and paying things off in the end. It ended up over $300,000. And almost all of it was donations, mostly from people who were part of the Assembly Center. And so when we had our ceremony, opening ceremony of that, many, many of the people came back after many years of being away from the fairgrounds where the Assembly Center was located. So that was an incredible process that we went through, and a wonderful thing that happened as an end result. I think it's a great educational tool now. Last year, there was a Christian school in Merced, and we have a speaking group of which I am the head out in the JCL, and we speak to most of the high schools, mostly juniors and seniors in high school, and we talk to them about our experience during this period of time, mm-hmm. and tell them in the end that we have a great country. And so we do a lot of speaking, but last year we had a group that came from the Christian, the new Christian school in Merced, mm-hmm. and there were about 100 people that came to the monument itself. We talked about it, and they enjoyed having it, being there. And it's a great educational tool, which we hope to expand over the years as we go along. So that's what we have done on that monument. It was a great, great affair.
I guess the one more thing I'll ask you, and not trying to put words in your mouth, but just hearing you talk about the Christian school there, and I heard you mention your church here growing up. Did faith play a role in your experience getting through everything that you got through, from being interned in Colorado to going overseas and through all of that?
Yes, I believe so. One of the questions I had was when I was a young man, I wondered how I'm going to feel about killing people, because if you're a soldier, you have to do that. And I mulled that over, and I think my Christian background that I had was very helpful in being able to live through that.
Makes sense to me. You lived through a lot, and in sharing your story here and all around Central California as you do, you've opened a lot of eyes, I'm pretty sure, and I think you've inspired quite a few folks. Thanks so much. That is Sherman Kishi of Livingston in Merced County. We're out of time today, but I hope you'll join us again next week, and if you can make it to Clovis Monday night at 7, join us for the Honor Flight documentary. I'm Paul Leffler, hoping you never forget that freedom is not free.